General Hutton, Reel 2. You wanted to add something.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people thought that you could abolish, say, so many regiments or battalions of this, that and the other and substitute tanks. Well, you couldn't. If you abolished anything or sold anything, barracks or what have you, the Treasury took the money, but you never got the money to spend. They'd have taken that and said, well, you present situation, you see no need to keep 5 battalions of guardsmen. Well, good, it's lovely, but a better bonus for us. But you wouldn't have got the money to spend on tanks. You'd have to justify that as fresh expenditure required by the needs of the moment, bearing in mind the 10 years rule.
Was there no capability within the War Office, when it received its annual budget, to switch funds from one head to another?
No, except by the permission of the Treasury.
Which you seem to be suggesting probably wouldn't have been forthcoming.
I think probably not, no. Yes. Well, within the terms laid down by the government, it would have been wrong.
Yes, because the estimates reflected a certain policy which had been argued by the War Office and accepted by Parliament as grounds for awarding the vote.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, one thing I would like to refer to, and it's very important, that is the question of the Air Force. The Air Force, obviously, were a new item in defence expenditure, and they realised very early on that they had no hope of getting millions of pounds to produce a modern Air Force in addition to the Army and Navy. That the only prospect they had of getting money, which they badly needed, was to substitute air forces for military and naval forces. Well, that's understandable. But, of course, it was carried to extremes. They claimed that practically everything the Army or the Navy could do, they could do better and cheaper. And the most fantastic ideas were promulgated in the Air Force Staff College.
Can you give me some examples?
Well, a good example is they said you could control the frontier of India with bombers. Well, of course you couldn't, but bombers were extremely useful in support of troops, but you've got to have the troops. And they took over Iraq. Well, they still had to have people on the ground. You could drop bombs on insurgent tribesmen and possibly reduce them to order, but you've got to have troops to show themselves on the ground. And it was really a necessary accessory and not a substitution. They discovered that, of course, the battleship was vulnerable to air bombing. So they wanted to abolish the battleship. But of course, the answer to that problem was the carrier. It was not you really needed a different type of battleship, which could carry airplane. And they weren't the least bit interested in cooperation with the other two services. I would go so far as to say that the Air Force was practically wasted during the whole of the early part of the Second World War. We dropped our bombs on Germany on objectives they couldn't hit. They dropped propaganda leaflets and so on. They refused the Navy the assistance they needed for dealing with the protection of convoys. And the troops in the Middle East got very limited air support, and the air support was never under the control of the commanders-in-chief. The air could say, we're not playing in this battle, and they didn't if they didn't want to.
Could you give me any examples of the kinds of problems this pressure from the Air Force for funding actually created for the Army? Specific problems that you may be able to recall?
Well, of course, there was a prolonged battle, went on for several years, over the defence of Singapore, which the Air Force said, all you want is a few aeroplanes, and you need to put the land peace down. We can always fly them out there if there's any threat to Singapore. And a more practical example is that when those two battle cruisers, I think they were, went out to Singapore without a carrier, because the carrier had run aground in Jamaica, I think, they felt it their duty to try and intercept this Japanese invasion. They approached the Air Force, who promised them air support from their aeroplanes on land-based aerodromes, but none of it ever appeared. Mm. They never had any air support. Mm. And the result is they were both sunk. Mm. It was one of the most terrible disasters of the whole war.
Yes. Going back to the period 1927 to 30, to what extent did this, as it were, challenge or threat from the Air Ministry preoccupy the War Office?
It preoccupied the War Office and the Navy quite a lot.
I was wondering whether that preoccupation may itself have been a handicap to the fuller consideration of other questions, of which mechanization
well,
would be
was.
One.
Oh, yes, I think it was.
Could you develop that a bit? Explaining why it was, how this
well,
militated against other
considerations. Well, the extreme view of the Air Force, which they propagated through their staff college, I talked to a man the other day who was there as a student, was that you had no need for conventional forces at all. Wars, as they should unfortunately happen, could be won by bombers. They weren't even interested in fighters. Very few people know that when they got a lot of money for the increase of the Air Force, they wanted to spend it all on bombers.
Yes.
And the politicians intervened and told them that they got to produce fighters to defend this country.
Yes, I take those points. What I'm rather more interested in is whether the preoccupation of the War Office with the Air Ministry challenge actually prevented it from giving as much attention as it might otherwise have done to other considerations.
I don't think so, no. Those things could take place at once.
I thought you were presenting this business of the Air Force as during the period you were at the War Office, occupying a very high proportion of War Office time.
Well, it did, particularly inter-service discussions and discussions with the politicians. Mm.
Did you attend any of those?
Oh, yes, I was on the CID committees on coast defence, air defence, and so on. They weren't interested in the anti-aircraft gunnery at all.
Mm.
We developed them, and the result was that outstanding victory when practically the whole of the V-2 bombers were shot down by anti-aircraft guns in the south of England. The Air Force couldn't get near them, of course.
Yes. I'm trying to keep you in 1927 to 30, and
well,
it's very
difficult.
Yes, but one other thing which interests me about this period, from reading the books which have been written on the subject of mechanization, often the issue is presented as if it were a conflict between the cavalry on the one hand and the tank corps on the other. And I wonder whether that was how it was perceived by people like yourself at the centre of things.
I don't think there was any conflict between the cavalry and the tank corps. No, but there were a number of people like Burnley Fuller and some extent Little Heart, who said, well, what are you spending all this money on cavalry for? Abolish the lot. And then you'll have some money to spend on tanks. But of course, it wasn't true. The treasury would have had the money, and we shouldn't have got the tanks.
The fact is, nonetheless, during this period, that the cavalry and horses were substantially more highly funded than the tank corps and tanks. And this seems to suggest that the cavalry was a more favoured arm, possibly by virtue of its tradition, seniority, the fact that many senior officers were cavalry officers, occupying positions of power within the service. I wonder, would you have any comments on that?
Well, the cavalry had to maintain a state of efficiency because they existed. And of course, some new tank units were formed, but very few. Mm. And there were no tanks for them. The existing tank was not entirely satisfactory, the ones that we'd finished the war with. We got to produce new ones, we got to decide on the composition, and then we had to get the money to buy them. Of course, we were greatly helped by the armament firms, who really helped the army enormously, because they produced the Vickers tank, they produced the new anti-aircraft gun, and they produced the 15-inch gun, which the army could never have got the money to provide for the treasury.
Yes.
They got the money to buy them once the Vickers had produced them, with a view to sales to other powers, of course.
While you were at the War Office with General Milne, the first two of the regular cavalry regiments were in fact mechanised, namely the 12th Lancers and the 11th Hussars.
Yes, the General Armoured Cars.
Yes. Did that mechanisation of two cavalry regiments have any repercussions? Did it excite much discussion?
Well, I think it made the cavalry and the army generally realise that the cavalry had a function, but they needed modern equipment to fulfil it. And those two regiments were very enthusiastic at being mechanised, very happy. Mm-hmm. And of course they carried that. I think they started the Second World War with armoured cars. Mm-hmm. It was later that those two regiments became tank units.
Yes. The office of the Commander of the Imperial General Staff is obviously as much a political office as it is a military office, in the sense that the CIGS has to operate in the political sphere.
Very much so.
What was your view of Milne as a dealer with politicians?
Of course, he wasn't known to the politicians at all at the beginning of this period, but they came to have great respect for him because he was always sound and very incisive in his views. And he has been criticised for having, as people say, hung on for 7 years. But the reason he stayed on was he's asked to. There was nobody else, really, to take his place, as was discovered with Montgomery Massingberg and various other people who came after him, were seen to be quite ineffective. Of course, if they could have gone down the list and taken somebody who was perhaps a major general or junior lieutenant general, they could have got some very good people, Charles Borges or Hugh Ellis. Hugh Ellis would have been very good. But the army system was such that people had to be considered in order of seniority. Navy is just the same. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's to this day, and so is the Air Force.
Could you tell me a little more about General Milne's style, his method of dealing with or working with politicians? How did he approach some of the difficult areas of negotiation with the political leaders?
Well, he was not without guile. He could spot the weak points in their arguments and very often defeat them.
Could you give me any examples to make that clearer?
It's very difficult to do that straight off, I mm-hmm. think about it. Well, Winston Churchill took a very strong line about abolishing the cavalry, and of course Mill said, well, that's splendid. First thing we'd do is to abolish the yeomanry, obviously not as important as the regulars. And the first unit to be mentioned in connection with the abolition of the yeomanry were the Oxford Bucks Hussars, which was Winston's old regiment. He That's dropped the subject nice. At once.
That's a very nice example.
And, other things, for instance, general strike. What are you going to do with aeroplanes or tanks in a general strike? What you needed was manpower. In fact, all the emergencies that occur during the interwar period demanded conventional forces and neither tanks nor aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Are there any more examples of General Milne acting when necessary with guile that occur to you? That was a very good one.
No, I can't. I'd probably think of some, but mm-hmm. I can't straight off. Not off the cuff. After all, it's 50 years ago.
Yes. When we were talking last time, I asked you... let me start again. You've already explained most convincingly how economic constraints very severely circumscribe what was possible and what was not possible during this period. Taking those into account, limiting as they did what was possible, did Milne have any particular plan about how mechanization could and should practicably be introduced?
Well, I think he arrived at pretty definite conclusions of what units should be included in a mechanized formation. And that was included in this purple primer, which he took a very great interest. Mm. And that organization was pretty well what the Germans had at the beginning of the Second World War, which we endeavored to have. And actually, we scored a very considerable success when we attacked the Germans in the flank with tanks at the beginning of the Second World War. I think Martel was in command. They did very well indeed, but with a very small force.
Yes. When I asked whether General Milne had any particular plan about how mechanization should be achieved, I was thinking not so much of how armoured forces should be mechanised and used, but rather more how new and larger elements of the army should be mechanised. Am I making myself clear? In other words, if the principle of mechanisation was accepted by General Milne, how in practice should the army be physically converted to a more mechanized condition?
Well,
do you have a plan?
No, it had all sorts of repercussions. For instance, they mechanized the artillery. They produced, I think it was called a Dragon, which is to replace the horse for towing guns about. And the whole idea was that an essential part of the future army should consist of tanks, and that the horse should, as far as possible, disappear, and mechanical vehicles of one kind or another take their place. We had self-propelled guns, for instance, and infantry carriers, which were not fully armoured, but they were armoured against small arm fire. And these little tankettes, as they were called at that period, little two-man tanks, like Beatles.
Yes. Well, one of the ways of achieving this mechanisation could have been to, over a period of time, gradually run down and phase out the cavalry regiments, and during the same period, over a period of time, gradually build up the size of the tank core.
Well, a far better solution was my own solution of using the personnel of the cavalry to form new tank units. Because the personnel of the cavalry was infinitely superior to the personnel of the tank corps.
In what respects?
Well, it was a corps d'élite, and it got very able men in it, both as officers and as NCOs. After all, Robertson was an ex-cavalry soldier, rose from the ranks to become Field Marshal CIGS, and it's very mistaken to abolish units with a long tradition and a very close connection with a large number of military families in order to raise just new units which have no tradition at all. And of course they establish themselves eventually, but it takes time.
I'm interested why you judge that the manpower, the personnel of the cavalry regiments was of a higher quality than the manpower of the tank corps at this period. I'm interested why you hold that view.
Well, there were, of course, a few very able people who transferred to the tank corps from other units, but most of them were people who enlisted during the war with temporary commissions or in the ranks. They had to be built up.
Yes.
There was no permanent nucleus in the tank corps from before the war because they didn't exist.
No. Let's move on to another question. Perhaps from the point of view of mechanization, the highlight of the period 1927 to 1930 was the establishment of the experimental mechanized force and the exercises with it. What part did Milne play in getting this force established?
Well, it was his idea. They started with an experimental unit or formation one, and then that was expanded to, I think it was three formations eventually. And it was hoped that they would evolve a suitable organization for the future when money became available to form and equip formations of tanks. Of course, they needed a lot more than just tanks. They needed an anti-tank gun, anti-aircraft guns, and a lot of engineering equipment to enable tanks to get across rivers or even streams or canals and so on. And the Martel Bridge was produced in that period. And various things were developed from what had happened during the war, such as a special kind of tank for dealing with mines.
Yes.
Go on.
Having then played a leading role in creating the experimental mechanized force, which carried out these major exercises in 1927 and 1928, What did Milne think the exercises achieved?
Well, I think we had pretty firm ideas as to what we wanted, as to what we should do if the money became available, because it never did until the last moment.
Was General Milne satisfied with the results of those experiments?
I think he thought as far as they went, they had arrived at the answer. Because you can never be satisfied when you're playing with just ideas or substitutes.
Yes. Last time we discussed this, you suggested that to some degree he was a little disappointed and that he had somewhat regretted the appointment of Collins to command the experimental mechanized force. Could you develop that a little for me?
Well, I think your opinion was general amongst people who were enthusiastic, because that Collins was typical infantry soldier, advanced ideas so far as use of machine guns and so on in the infantry was concerned, but he never seemed to produce anything revolutionary in ideas. He was really, I think, a failure. I think that was the conclusion of most people at the time.
Do you recollect whether General Mill felt disappointed after
these
2 years?
Oh, yes, he certainly did.
Why was that?
Well, I think this so-called force, didn't produce the results that he hoped for. And that is a definite proposal for a formation, composition, and equipment of a mechanized formation.
I suppose it could be argued that perhaps it was hoping for a little too much on the basis of 2 years of training exercises only.
Well, obviously, it had a limited opportunity to produce ideas, and after that you've got to put them into practice and try them out, and of course there was no money to do it.
So that was the final question I was going to ask you. Why the experiments with the EMF were not continued beyond just the 2 years?
Well, just because there were no tanks, no money. Simple as that.
Can't argue about that, can you?
Come on.
There. It's on the question of tank production. Almost throughout the entire interwar period, tank production was dominated by Vickers. And I wonder whether you'd have any comments to make, particularly from the War Office point of view, as to whether that dominance of tank production by one major industrial company was wholly satisfactory from the Army's point of view.
I would say that it was, because there was no possible hope of setting up a production unit in the Army. And after all, Vickers took a terrible risk, because they knew we wouldn't buy many of these things. Their only hope of making a profit on what they produced was selling them to foreign powers.
Yes. But it seems to me that throughout the period, the Army ran down its expertise on tank design and production. I mean, the Woolwich capacity was gradually eroded throughout the entire interwar period, and I wonder whether that, in a way, made the Army much more dependent upon the only experts that thereafter remained, namely those of Vickers.
Well, of course, we never produced a tank in Woolwich Arsenal. We were entirely dependent on the armament firms. The same with the anti-aircraft gun to a large extent, although there was very close collaboration with the Vickers and other firms over equipment. And of course it was the same thing in the Navy. I mean, the Navy almost lived with Vickers when they were producing a new destroyer or battleship or what have you, and had an tremendous influence on design.
So you never...
The big thing we did was, when radar was invented, we claimed radar for the Army as well as the Air Force, because we said we wanted it to direct our guns. The Air Force laughed at that and said, of course, it'll be no use. It can't be accurate enough to be any good for guns. We wanted to locate the enemy aircraft for our fighters. Well, we won our point. I was at the meeting, in fact, fought the battle. And, of course, before very long, we had got a predictor, depending on radar, that would ensure that